As soon as stigma around something starts to decrease, even just a little bit, it's like a wedge that opens the floodgates, and all of a sudden it's allowed to identify that way. So, like, as soon as nuns stopped slapping children for using their left hand, more and more people became left-handed because it was safer to do so. As soon as, you know, I don't know my queer history as well as I should, but, you know, when once people started speaking up and identifying as that in a public way, it was like, oh, it might not be completely safe, but it's worth it for me. Like, I need to be myself. And it's not that people suddenly became queer. It's that they always were, but it wasn't safe. It wasn't welcome. It wasn't. A lot of people didn't even realize they were because it felt so incredibly not allowed that it
Like, I
was
didn't
like,
even know
oh.
this was an option, right?
And I think neurodivergence is much the same way. And I think the wedge that has opened the floodgates is social media and TikTok.
If you're a high achiever who wants your ambition to extend beyond your professional goals and into your well-being and relationships, you're in the right place. I'm Valerie Martin, a certified high-performance coach and therapist of 12 years, and I'm obsessed with teaching and coaching folks how to cultivate compassionate self-discipline. We all have a spark alive within us, no matter how small or dim it might feel right now. And it is our greatest purpose and our greatest responsibility to honor it. Because when we do, we become better partners, leaders, parents, creators, and family members in the interconnected web of this wild, dark, miraculous, beautiful world. Tune in every other week for a new interview or solo episode and connect with me on Instagram at Honor Your Spark. Let's jump into the episode. Hi, you guys. Welcome back to another episode of Honor Your Spark. And I'm going to jump right into what I've been watching, reading, and loving recently. So my husband and I are very slowly, over the span of years, making our way through the Marvel Cinematic Universe in timeline order on the Disney Plus app. And it is so much fun. I know they're trash, but also, I mean, they're not all trash. Like, let's be honest. Guardians of the Galaxy is legitimately good film. But we watched recently Spider-Man Far From Home, and I just have to say, as someone who doesn't normally follow the Hollywood gossip, I just really love Tom Holland and Zendaya together. They are so cute, and the fact that they started dating like 6 years ago or something crazy like that when they did the first Spider-Man, just adorable. Love them. Recently, I've been reading a book called Women Without Kids by Ruby Warrington, and I will probably do, I might invite Ruby onto the podcast. I hope she would say yes. I might do a whole podcast about being child-free. It's one of those things, just like my veganism, where I'm like, ooh, don't talk about this. You don't want to alienate people. But you know what? Like, it's fine. I'm not here judging anyone else's choices or saying that mine is the right and best way. And it is a part of my identity. And I know for many women who are child-free, whether it's by choice, by circumstance, that it's something that can feel pretty isolating. And so I'd love to have more conversations about it. If that's something that you're interested in, shoot me a DM or an email. I would love to connect. And I actually read this book as part of a new book club that I'm in here in Nashville that is all child-free women. And we're not always going to read books of this topic, but it was a really wonderful start. This book just came out like within the last year. And it's honestly, it's not at all like a like kid bashing, like bash the breeders kind of book. Like, she does such a thorough and measured exploration of why a woman might make that choice, or even if she's not making a choice, if it's circumstantial, like what that is like. Really, really, really excellently done book. So highly recommend that. And then loving. So I did not get a great night's sleep last night because I was out at the Death Cab for Cutie Postal Service tour, and this is touring the 20th anniversary of both Transatlanticism by Death Cab and Give Up by the Postal Service. If this sounds like, didn't you already go to the show? Yeah, I did, in October in Los Angeles. We had bought tickets for that months before the show when they were first announced. They were not coming here, and I don't know if they were always going to do a second leg. Maybe they probably needed to see how the first leg went.
But they added another leg. And so after the holidays, they started touring again and they had added Nashville to the list. And so we're like, yeah, we're going to go. I mean, these are two of my favorite albums of all time. So it was great, except we got stuck in the parking garage. We didn't move for like almost an hour. It was excruciating. It's like, okay, if I had brought something fun to do, I mean, I guess you always have yourself and your phone or whatever, but it was 11:30 and we just wanted to go home because it was a school night. I mean, I say that metaphorically, but it's literal for my husband because he's a teacher. So it was late, but it was a fantastic show. Okay, let me tell you about our wonderful guest for today. Megan Griffith is a neurodivergent life coach and ADHDer herself. She loves working with folks on executive dysfunction, emotional dysregulation, and internalized shame. And when she's not working, you can probably find her dyeing her hair. Megan is one of those people that she went totally viral on TikTok, had like hundreds of thousands of followers. And we will talk in the episode about why she's, at the time that we recorded this, she had not left TikTok. I do believe that she's not there anymore. And that will make sense when you hear some of the conversation. But I was so impressed how Megan handled that whole like chaotic situation that went down over the last few months with TikTok. And she's just so good at articulating some of these concepts that relate to autism and ADHD. And I love her stuff. So I was like, please come on the pod. And she was down. You can find Megan online at theneurocuriosityclub.com and on Instagram at theneurocuriosityclub. And what a cool brand, right? So before we jump into the conversation with Megan, I want to tell you that if you are listening to this shortly after it is published, I am running a limited promotion for my signature membership, Lit AF. Through May 12th only, you can join my Lit AF annual membership. And instead of the usual, like you get 3 months free because you're getting annual, you get 5 months free and you get a bonus coaching session with me. Those two things alone are hundreds of dollars of value, and that's not inflated. That's just the literal value of these. And you just get those for free if you join before May 12th. So I highly recommend it. I mean, yeah, I'm biased, but I've put so much work into continuing to make this membership super valuable and fun. Lit AF is your home base for inspiration, motivation, accountability, coaching, and overall support to consistently follow through on your big dreams, to make those behavior changes, habit changes, mindset shifts, and yeah, also do all the obnoxious to-dos that we just have to do in life and that we sometimes struggle to follow through with. I add new members only content multiple times every week. So basically you're getting ridiculously valuable and engaging teaching and support from me, a certified high performance coach, therapist of 12 years, multi six-figure business owner, and you're getting that for only $67 a month. You can cancel anytime. So if you want to get out of procrastination, self-judgment, back into feeling lit the fuck up and slaying your goals, come on in. This is about honoring your spark, honoring your ambition in a grounded, sustainable way, not about hustling yourself into the ground and burning out, okay? If this is resonating with you, you belong inside Lit AF. So jump in, whether you're listening to this after the promo or not, hopefully you're catching it in time. You can go to honoryourspark.com/lit-AF. That's honoryourspark.com/lit-AF, and that will be in the show notes. All right, let's jump into the conversation with Megan Griffith. Megan, I am so excited for this conversation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what does it mean to you to honor your spark?
I love this question. I have maybe a little bit of an unconventional answer, but stick with me. For me, I think honoring my spark means that the wildfire that results is not necessarily my fault. And it doesn't mean I should put myself out to begin with. Like, so what I mean by that is I've spent my whole life not honoring my spark at all and seeing my spark as a problem for other people and an inconvenience. And so I'm like, oh, okay, I'll just hide that. I'll just stop that. I'll just, you know, keep myself in a very little box, basically, because if we're sticking with the spark metaphor, I was afraid I was going to start a wildfire and it would be my fault and people would get hurt. And it was because I was like inherently bad. And honoring my spark now looks like, no, if there's a wildfire because of me, like, it's not just because of me. It's because of the rain patterns. It's because of the forest layout. It's because of litterers. It's because of, you know, all kinds of factors go into that. It's not just like, oh, you're a terrible, horrible person. It's a lot of stuff. And there's other people have some responsibility in that as well. And on top of that, fires, when well controlled, can actually bring about a lot of new growth. And sometimes it's not the end of the world to burn shit down.
Woo! Drop the mic. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and to go from like, yeah, that like, oh, I'll just keep my spark here, but like very, very, very small. And like, it doesn't upset anybody. It's like, no. And hell, I mean, you've been through the ringer recently. And that if you were in a place where you were believing that, then you could just say, oh, see, yep, I was right. You know, I should have just kept quiet. I should have just kept in my own little box. And it's like you said, I mean, there's so many variables at play when things do get kind of wonky and wild. And when they do, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Even if there are aspects where we're like, oh, okay, that was a learning experience, but there's often more good that comes as a result of when things kind of blow up in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things where you want to do your best to mitigate harm, but at the same time, sometimes the stuff that feels really sucky in the moment can be really powerful down the road.
Absolutely. So you have this beautiful creation called the Neurocuriosity Club, which I'm obsessed with the name that you chose. I love it. And I know community is really important to you. So if there's something you want to share just around sort of the evolution of how you got to Neurocuriosity Club, and that may also speak to the thing I mentioned vaguely about the ringer you've been through recently, but then yeah, really it's about celebrating what you're creating too.
Yeah. So that's like my least favorite thing when I listen to a podcast and they're like hinting at something that went down and it's like, just tell me. So, okay, here's what happened, everybody. Basically, I was a pretty like decent sized creator over on TikTok and I made a couple of pretty big mistakes. And when I say that, I don't mean like, oh, someone misinterpreted it or it got misconstrued. I mean, I messed up. So I just want to own that wholeheartedly. So the first thing that happened is I started a conversation that I was not the correct person to lead. I started a conversation around autism and whether it was disorder or a disability. Mm-hmm. And I was staunchly in the camp that it was a disability and not a disorder. And on top of that, not that that's a problem, having your own opinion is fine, mm-hmm. but I didn't present it as my opinion. I presented mm-hmm. it as the truth. And anyone who disagreed with me was, you know, small-minded, basically. I was pretty aggressive about it. And I was rude and condescending. So I regret the way I talked about it. I don't know that I regret starting the conversation, but I should have started it and then handed it off to people who knew more than me. That's what I should have done. Sure. And that's not what I did. So that was mistake number one. And I tried to apologize for that, but there were a lot of hurt feelings. And I still hadn't learned what I now know, which is the value of self-sovereignty, which is the idea that every person is sovereign unto themselves. There is no king ruling over us, telling us how we are supposed to think or feel about our neurodivergence. And that's what I was trying to be. I was trying to be the king. Having a lot of followers on TikTok can make you feel a little invincible sometimes and lead you to make some pretty silly, hurtful decisions. And I feel like that's what happened. So that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was unrelated, but it was very close timeline-wise, which led to people thinking that my previous apology was insincere because I screwed up again almost immediately after. And they're like, you clearly didn't do the work. And they were kind of right. I didn't, like I said, I hadn't learned about self-sovereignty yet. That's something I've learned in my recent weeks. I took off from content creation in order to reflect and be like, why am I making so many mistakes back to back? Like, what's going on here? So the mistake was I had gotten a couple of questions from different people saying like, how did you become a life coach? Like, could you teach me and all this stuff? And I was like, sure. And I put together something called the Neurodivergent Life Coach Certification Course. I woke up at like 6 a.m. and did not have this idea. But by 6 p.m., it was outlined. There was a sales page and I was promoting it.
Like, I know that feeling.
We
well.
Are talking about ADHD, hyperfixation,
yeah,
hyperfocus. And I just, someone asked me and I was like, let me just make a course real quick. Like, mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. Couple of problems with that. Number one, I called it the Neurodivergent Life Coach Certification Course. And a lot of people were like, that's not helpful. You mostly work with autistic folks and ADHDers, and pretending that the word neurodivergent only pertains to those things is really harming the neurodivergent community at large. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. So that's a big reason for the rebrand, which we'll get to in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But the other problem was the use of the word certification. So even though it was completely legal for me to use the word certification because life coaching is an unregulated industry, that doesn't mean it was an ethical thing for me to do. It implies a level of expertise that I don't have. I've always, up until this point, been very clear that I'm a lived experience expert, yeah. Not anyone who has like a business degree or a psychology training. Degree. I have a minor in psychology, but that's it, you know? And so by offering a certification course, I was way overstepping my scope of practice. Like, yeah, it was bad. And people called me out on it. People were really upset. And frankly, even though it was hurtful for a couple different reasons, there were a lot of people who made videos about me who had direct access to me who elected not to utilize that and instead mm-hmm. make a public video, which felt maybe not the kindest way to approach it. But at the same time, I really admire people's drive to protect their community. Mm-hmm. I really do. And so, yeah, so I messed up in some pretty big ways, basically. And I decided if I wanted to fix this, I had to dedicate myself to really fixing it. And that meant rebranding, not because I wanted to hide my mistakes, which mm-hmm. I'm afraid some people will think that's why I rebranded, mm-hmm. but I have to let that go and make the decision that's best for my community. And that decision meant no longer calling myself a neurodivergent life coach or calling my business Neurodivergent Magic, because these people were right. I mostly work with people who aren't sure where they fit or mm-hmm. they're autistic and ADHD. Like, those are the two main groups of people I work with. So I went ahead and rebranded to the Neuro Curiosity Club. And the idea is I am an ADHD life coach for the neuro curious. That's like my new title. Cool. I like it a lot. It feels yes. very specific, which makes me feel better about the work I do. And yeah, the Neuro Curiosity Club is really designed for people who think they might be ADHD or they might be autistic or they might be both, or maybe there's something else and they're just not sure. And I can't diagnose at all. Period. Like, cannot do that. What I can do though is be like, hey, I was in the same boat for like a decade. I can walk you through this. Like, I can help you find peace within yourself, whatever the diagnosis ends up being.
Beautiful. And I just want to really commend you for how clearly that you are owning the mistakes you've made without being defensive. And I think that is a really hard thing to do. And I, you know, were there moments where any of that showed up, or certainly it shows up internally, but like in how I'm hearing you articulate it so genuinely right now, like you're just so clearly owning it. And it's also not an easy thing to do when the way that some people respond, and like you said, you know, people are going to protect their community, and we cannot fault them for that. And we want people to call out when mistakes are being made. And sometimes it can take on a tone of sort of personal attack, and just, it can take on a tone that is harsh and cruel, and like, and that just sucks. And that's just something that is kind of par for the course when you're a quote unquote public persona, like you had, you know, become, that there's this responsibility and also this, like, sometimes power that we maybe don't even want that much power, because then people are like, yo. So I just wanted to reflect that. And I did, you know, read some of those things, and I was like, I didn't go too far in the weeds, because there were times where I was like, I wanted to respond. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to observe. Like, Megan's got this, and she's, you know, but it's been really, I think, an experience to see a lot of grace that you've brought into a very hard situation. So I just commend you for that.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a zine that I'm going to order. I haven't ordered it yet, but I love the title. It's by Clementine Morrigan, and the title is Fuck the Police Means That We Don't Act Like Cops to Each Other.
Oof.
And it's all about cancel culture. It's like a three-part zine, and I need to read it. So
That
I'm very
sounds
excited.
excellent. Yeah, I'll have to put that in the show notes and check that out too, 'cause yes, I am, that is generally the if there is a camp that I am in, it is like, how can we hold each other accountable without, going into this all or nothing bandwagon cancel culture that can be really harsh and cruel and very not nuanced. But here you've been through this like massive learning experience and coming through the other side and bringing all of your learning and your values and your integrity into this next chapter, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I'm super pumped. I love working with people who are neurocurious, who are exploring, and I'm really excited to draw more of those people in with more accurate marketing.
This episode is brought to you by a private podcast from yours truly, called You Are Motherfucking Enough. It's a four-part series that will teach you how to shift from patterns of self-doubt and criticism to owning your enoughness. I created You Are Motherfucking Enough because I'm tired of seeing how often self-doubt, shame, and constant criticism hold people back from stepping fully into their purpose, passion, and aliveness. And I believe that it takes a lot more than just an empathetic listener, whether that's a therapist, coach, or friend, to actually learn and apply the strategies that will allow you to make that positive shift long term. I'm not kidding, y'all. The value of these episodes is worth the cost of multiple therapy or coaching sessions. And you can get instant access to this series for $0. I've condensed 12 years of experience working with these issues into 60 minutes of content. You don't want to miss this one. Get instant free access to listen almost anywhere you get your podcasts by signing up at honoryourspark.com/enough. That link will also be in the show notes for the episode that you're currently listening to. All right, let's get back to the show. So, I would love to know your general thoughts. This is a pretty broad question. We'll see where we go with it. But one thing that is very obvious to me as a clinician and an elder millennial who's seen some things over the decades now about why you think neurodiversity and neurodivergence have in recent years come a lot more into the mainstream. I think there are people who are maybe very apart from those worlds who are like, why is this so trendy now? And whatever. So, like, why? Help us understand.
Absolutely. So this is a very well-studied phenomenon. We noticed it with left-handedness. We noticed it with being queer. We've noticed it with all kinds of identities and ways of being. As soon as stigma around something starts to decrease, even just a little bit, it's like a wedge that opens the floodgates, and all of a sudden it's allowed to identify that way. So, like, as soon as nuns stopped slapping children for using their left hand, more and more people became left-handed because it was safer to do so. As soon as, I don't know my queer history as well as I should, but when once people started speaking up and identifying as that in a public way, it was like, oh, it might not be completely safe, but it's worth it for me. Like, I need to be myself. And it's not that people suddenly became queer. It's that they always were, but it wasn't safe. It wasn't welcome. It wasn't. A lot of people didn't even realize they were because it felt so incredibly not allowed that it
Like, I
was
didn't
like,
even know
oh.
this was an option, right?
And I think neurodivergence is much the same way. And I think the wedge that has opened the floodgates is social media and TikTok, frankly. I think the DSM is an interesting tool. I think there's a lot of problems with it, but I also think it can be very helpful. I think it's both. But one of the issues with the DSM around autism specifically, but also I think it applies to other experiences and conditions, is one thing a lot of autistic folks have in common. We're all different, but a lot of us deal with very literal thinking. And the DSM criteria are written in a way that we don't see ourselves in a literal way, And so social media changes that though, because it allows us to view real autistic people with real autistic traits. And we're like, oh, wait, but that is me. And I think that was the wedge. And a lot of people are identifying with it. And a lot of studies are currently being done on the validity of self-diagnosis. And everything that comes out has been very promising, saying like, hey, obviously every self-diagnosis isn't going to be correct, but a vast majority of the time you're on the right track, you know?
Yeah, that's very cool. And I completely agree about the DSM. It's like, you know, especially living in the bullshit managed care world that we do, it's like, hey, if a diagnosis is going to let you get the support that you need, by all means, go for it. You know, unless it's like, obviously, there can be the downsides of seeking official diagnosis, which are also very real. So it's up to each person and why self-diagnosis is a totally valid thing. If somebody does not choose to seek that out officially, like, by all means. There's no like autism police out there who are going to be like, no, you're not. I mean, if you're filing for accommodations at work or something, like, yeah, they might want, you know, legit paperwork. But it's philosophically speaking, it's like people know themselves. And to me, the thing that is so cool about seeing all of this, and I'm really interested, I haven't done a ton of learning yet about just like outside of, you know, like you said earlier, neurodiversity is much broader than just autism and ADHD. And I'm really curious about the rest of that sort of, you know, spectrum or area and what it's going to look like 20 years from now. And I think what's so neat about it is that we are acknowledging all of the ways that we operate differently, and we're being given language to explain that in a way that doesn't imply pathology or mental illness. Like, there are times where it might travel with, you know, anxiety disorder or whatever other things, but just because you operate differently and process things differently in this way doesn't mean that it is pathological.
Yes. So I'm reading this book, or I just finished it, We're All Neurodiverse by Sunny Jane Wise.
Gosh.
So good.
Okay.
But they articulate a couple of ways that it is possible to diverge. And I love some of the things they talk about. So let me see if I can find them.
Okay. While you're looking for that, I'll just share with the audience that when you showed that, it reminded me of a store. If anyone listening is ever in Asheville, North Carolina, they have such a cute little shopping district in their kind of main, I don't know if it's downtown or whatever that area is. And one of the stores is called Madam Clutterbucket's Neurodiverse Universe. And it is the best store. They have all the stickers, all the buttons, like all kinds of just weird shit. And it is like that. It was my favorite store I went to when I visited last year.
That sounds incredible, and I need to go. Okay, so some of the ways they list that it's possible to diverge are emotions, which includes, you know, emotional regulation, intensity of emotions, and empathy. Another one is communication and social norms. And some of the things they challenge in this book is you must express an appropriate amount of emotion through verbal and nonverbal body language when communicating. You must be able to assume or interpret someone's feelings and intentions based off their tone of voice. It is important to make eye contact. You cannot interrupt, you know, so all kinds of social norms that some of us diverge from. Then there's learning. So just how we learn and all of that stuff, learning patterns. Time, we can diverge in the ways we perceive time. And that a lot of us think of ADHD and what used to be called time blindness, the visually blind community has asked us to shift to something more like misperception of time. But also Sunny Jane also talks about plurality. That's the last one in here, which is, you know, being like a system, having alters, dissociative identities and stuff like that. So it's fascinating, like how many different things fit under the neurodivergent umbrella.
And how that will all be conceptualized as we learn more. And, you know, research is like good and bad, right? Because it's like, it's so limited. It can, so often we aren't getting quote unquote real three-dimensional people in research because we try to control for all these variables. But the very type of, you know, people that we're often wanting to learn more about with this kind of stuff, like, we can't control for all the other variables of the things that might travel along with that, because we're also living in a world that wasn't built for neurodiverse people. And so it's, guess what? Sometimes that might mean depression develops or more traumatic experiences happen and all these other things that we can't just take out of the variables in terms of research, nonetheless, I'm sure that there will be some really interesting work done around all of this in the coming years, and it's exciting to think about.
Yeah, that's something Sunny Jane mentions as well, is that not only do we need more research on neurodivergence, we need research that's being directed by neurodivergent people so that we can research what we want to know and what would actually help us.
Totally. So you talk some, because I think there is an overlap here, about like adult gifted kids. And I talk about that a lot too, because I work with high performers, high achievers, and very often, you know, it's like we've been doing it since we were small. And sometimes that translates to what looks like external success, quote unquote, in adulthood. And also sometimes it doesn't necessarily look like that, because perfectionism or just, you know, burnout, like all these other variables that come along with like pushing maybe too hard, maybe in a way that is counter to someone's well-being, is too much about trying to fit into the societal expectations. Like for all those reasons, even someone who is like very quote unquote gifted, talented in some capacity may or may not be, you know, doing that in their adult life. But you shared some kind of reel about a regression. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I would love for you to share about that, because I remember thinking like, oh, that is such a useful term.
Yes. Okay. Before we jump in, I just want to mention that there is a bit of a stereotype in the autism world specifically that we all tend to be gifted or high achieving or whatever. Like, I've even seen some pretty reputable autism resources say that like high IQ is associated with autism. And I just want to point out that the research doesn't support that. Cool. Autistic people have a very wide diversity in all kinds of things, including our quote unquote IQ. And we can be intelligent in a wide variety of ways. We can be intellectually disabled and be autistic. And all of that is welcome. And we need more discussions about autistic folks who aren't gifted potentially, and like what that looks like and how different struggles can present, because it's just, we don't want one narrative. We don't want to replace one narrative with another one narrative. We want a variety of narratives. So just throwing that out there. But that being said, I do relate to personally this idea of growing up in gifted programs and then later finding out I was autistic. And something that a lot of, it's called twice exceptional when you are both gifted and disabled. Mm-hmm. A lot of twice exceptional folks experience something called skill regression. And this is where you are like, I just don't understand why I'm struggling so much. I used to be able to do 8 times what I can do right now. And I just feel like I must be making it up. I must be lazy, because I used to be able to do it. And so the only thing that's changed is like, I must not be trying as hard. I must be the problem, which is, if you think about it, doesn't make any sense, because you're the only common variable. You're the only common denominator. You're the only thing that hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. So like, why would you be the problem? But that's because that's what society tells us. So I think skill regression is basically when you build skills and then due to burnout usually or lack of supports as you get older and supports are taken away as you are expected to do more by yourself, you regress in those skills. So a great example for me is I really struggle to read now. Whereas in middle school, high school, I could, you know, churn out a 500-page novel in a weekend, no big deal. Now it took me 2 months to read this book. It is not a big book, you know? I did finish it though, and I'm very proud. But yeah, so skill regression for me looks like really struggling with reading, especially when I used to be able to do it. And there's lots of reasons for skill regression. Like I said, burnout is a really common one, but losing supports is another. So like as we get older and some of us move out onto our own or move in with a partner and no longer have a parent who is doing, or maybe some people who grew up in a home where their parent wasn't able to do a bunch of stuff for them, we have to do more. And without the supports, our other skills start to fall away.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting. And then there's like the conversation around, I mean, your reading example is perfect of this, like skill regression that applies to all of us as a result of living in a culture, a society that is just increasingly not built for the way that our animal bodies are designed. just the constant hyperstimulation. And, you know, I'm not certainly not anti-tech or even anti-social media, but I think it is not arguable just how much it has impacted our brains. And I think we are not even scratching the surface on really what that looks like and what the trajectory is. But I read Johan Hari's excellent book, Stolen Focus. I mean, even though I have also had difficulty for years reading, I devoured that one because I was just like, please help me understand what's happened to me. And in it, I mean, he talks with people who've been professors, researchers for decades who now can't seem to sit and read for 10 minutes at a time. So it's like, it's a phenomenon that is not only happening with folks who are, say, ADHD. And that's another thing that I think is tricky to parse out is like, of course, ADHD is real, right? In the sense is there's this can be this organic brain difference. But then, you know, there's people like me who I don't meet their traditional criteria of having displayed XYZ symptoms before the age of 12, but I do meet the symptomatic criteria now. And so it's, you know, how much of what we're seeing as modern ADHD is like, okay, yes, this category is like organic brain difference. And this category over here is sort of more culture bound and created by rewiring our brains.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And that's something we talked about in my assessment, which was originally supposed to only be an autism assessment. But halfway through, she was like, yeah, we're going to look at ADHD too. I was like, okay. But that's something we talked about a little bit was the way I behaved as a child. Because I was like, honestly, there were some signs for sure, but not as many as there are now. And I brought that up because I was like, I don't want you to think that means I don't have it, although it maybe means I don't. But I was masking really heavily at the time, mm-hmm. like really, really hiding stuff. I grew up in a very practical Midwestern family where my big emotions and my forgetfulness and my inability to regulate was not welcome. It was not seen as a struggle. It was seen as like, why are you doing this to us? So I think it's important. Yeah, culture is hugely important. Tech is important to consider. Environment, that's something. There's a great Tumblr post that I love that's like, why is everybody autistic nowadays? And it's like, well, maybe it's because in the 1700s, when little Josiah was autistic and he could just go enjoy himself amongst the sheep as he herded them and it wasn't so goddamn overstimulating all yes. the time. Yeah, he was a little weird, but it wasn't as debilitating as it is in our current society. Yes. And I was like, okay, now wait.
I like that. So yeah, there's so much good stuff there. You mentioned to me something that you call the helpful versus not helpful framework. Tell us about that.
Okay. So I had a therapist who was not very helpful to me, generally speaking. She was fine. She wasn't unhelpful. She just wasn't super helpful. It was fine, except for this one like life-altering paradigm that she introduced to me, which is helpful versus not helpful. Because at the time, it was before my diagnoses, and I had been misdiagnosed with bipolar. I had been told I have a shame-based personality, whatever that means. Mm. I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety a bunch, but like that never felt right. And I was just very, very obsessed with my mental health, like in a very unhealthy way. And something this therapist introduced to me, she was like, okay, you're very concerned about whether your behavior, your thoughts, your feelings are normal or abnormal, healthy or unhealthy, disordered or not disordered. And she's like, what if you started thinking in terms of what is helpful to me and what is not helpful to me? I'm not even kidding. My whole life changed. Like that, I use that language all the time now. That's all I really consider because, yeah, something can be objectively true and still not be helpful. And it doesn't mean you're denying the truth or like hiding from reality. It just means that it doesn't help to focus on it all the goddamn time, you know?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. That comes out of acceptance and commitment therapy, which is like one of my sort of pet theories because it's so existential and so realistic. And yeah, it's like even where old school CBT would have us be like, well, is it true or is it not true? Show me the evidence to support this thought. And ACT is like, I don't know, like, is it helpful? Because if not, maybe like we can't get rid of it, but we can unhook from it some. We can get some distance from it if we realize that being totally fused with it
isn't helping us.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's been mind-blowing for me. It's helped with so many things. It didn't totally relieve the mental health obsession, because I think something I've realized is, because ever since getting my autism and ADHD diagnosis, I've had one or two little week-long bouts of obsession again, but that's it. And it's been years. Like, that's so different from how it used to be. Yeah. And I think the big reason I was so obsessed is because I knew I didn't have the right answers and I wanted the right answers. So the helpful versus unhelpful didn't totally stop me from thinking, is, do I have this or do I have that? But it did help me see that diagnosis is helpful up to a point, but it isn't going to magically solve all my problems.
Totally. Yes. Okay. I have a completely unrelated question for you, just because this is, you know, something that is kind of unique about you that I'm sure, you know, a lot of people ask you about this. You have one kiddo and then you have two infant twins, right? And I mean, just like being a twin mom, I'm sure, is just a whole other universe of living. So I'm curious if there's anything that you want to share just about what that's like, or even what's frustrating about what people might assume it's like.
I actually haven't had too many assumptions for the most part. Okay. I've actually met a shocking number of other twin parents on social media and stuff, which has been amazing and so nice. I think the biggest thing for me is like my twin pregnancy sucked.
Oh, I bet.
It was so hard, which is funny because my singleton pregnancy was great. Like my executive dysfunction was in the toilet, but my mood was super elevated the whole time, which was awesome. Mm. But this time, everything was in the toilet. I was physically in pain. I was mentally in pain. I wasn't able to get anything done. I had to change up some of my medications, which was really stressful. Mm-hmm. I tried to just go off one of them entirely with my doctor's assistance, but we tried that. And I was like, no, this is not,
unwell.
I'm not going to make it 9 months. So yeah, it was hard. They came pretty early. They were born at 36 weeks or 36 and 5, 36 and 2, something like that. Mm-hmm. So early, but it was like scheduled because of the type of twins they were. There's some risks associated with letting them cook longer. And I can't even tell you how relieved I was. If I had to go to 40 weeks, I would have imploded. It was brutal at the end there.
Oh man, I bet. Twins are just one of those things. I don't know if it was Sweet Valley that did this to me or what, but I've always been obsessed with twins, and I'm sure that being a twin, like, it'll be interesting as they come into their identities and everything and social, just all of the additional sort of like really cool shit, but also challenges that come along with that.
Oh yeah. I can't tell you how much better I feel now that they're here. And I'm not pregnant anymore. Like literally the day
the rest of this is going to be cake compared to that.
Oh yeah. The day of my C-section, they were like, oh, can you like rate your pain 0 to 10? And I was like, 0. And they're like, what? And I'm like, my dude, I was in so much pain before this. 0. I'm in no pain. It was crazy. I felt so much better. And just the day of like not being pregnant anymore was glorious.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
So, yes, where can people find the Neuro Curiosity Club and everything else that you are up to these days?
So I've got just your run-of-the-mill website, theneurocuriosityclub.com. That's where you can find all kinds of stuff, lots of freebies. You can book a call with me. And I have a blog now that I'm very excited about. So that'll be fun. I'm also on YouTube and Instagram and podcasts as the Neuro Curiosity Club. So you can find me there. And then if anybody's interested, I actually have a free event coming up. I don't know if it'll be before or after when this comes out, but it's March 11th through the 13th. And if this comes out after that point, don't worry. Those same trainings are available pre-recorded. So again, just go to my website, theneurocuriosityclub.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Yes, friend, you made it to the end of the episode. I so appreciate you tuning in. And if you enjoyed this episode, make my day by subscribing and leaving a 5-star rating to help other people find this podcast. I'd love for you to connect with me on Instagram at honoryourspark. And don't forget to sign up for my 4-episode private podcast series all about kicking self-criticism to the curb at honoryourspark.com/enough. See you in the next episode.